3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
RCR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, everyone, and you're listening to 3CR Breakfast on Tuesday, the 2nd of September, 2025. Thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear, peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and in the studio today we've got Juliet and Elena. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How is everyone going? I know that there have been, some really intense things going on in Nam in the last couple of days, so... yeah, just wanted to check in with you both. How are you going?
Yeah, I'm going okay. Yeah, I feel like it was a very intense weekend. Very scary stuff happening. Mm. With my friends, we went out and had some yum cha as a sort of nourishing and sort of community activity, which was really lovely. I think everybody's seen the photo of, the... awful protesters going to Yumcha, and I was just like infuriated by it afterwards. I was like, this is not your place.
So just want to say I think we've all seen the footage, so take care of yourselves and take care of each other. I know that there are ways that you can support that are like floating around online, especially those who were impacted by police violence, who were arrested, and also for the people who were attacked at Camp Sovereignty. So I know there are some like mutual aid funds going around online, so if you have the means, please contribute to those. And I know that Uncle Robbie Thorpe did do some reporting on his show yesterday about what happened at Camp Sovereignty, so check that out as well. Really look out for each other, and take care of yourselves as well during this time. Let's have a chat about what's coming up on today's show. Juliet, what are we listening to first this morning?
So we're starting at 7:15. We're going to be listening to Dr. Summer Badu, who is a psychiatrist, psychotherapist and writer from Palestine, who came to Nam recently as part of her book launch for the book Radiance in Pain and Resilience. So we're going to hear a little clip from that event about her experiences working in the field.
And then at 7:30, we'll be joined by Kristen O'Connell from the Anti-Poverty Centre to talk about the changes made to Centrelink debt policies that were announced by the government last week. But we'll also be talking about how victim survivors of domestic and family violence are often unfairly held responsible for debts, and make sure that you tune into Thursday Breakfast as well, because Inez will be speaking to Jay from the Anti-Poverty Centre as well, and they'll be continuing the conversation about debt issues and how to improve the social security system. At 7:45, we'll be joined by Zelda from Disrupt Wars, who will be talking to us about the snap action that's being called for today at 12:30 p.m. outside the Indonesian embassy. This is to stand in solidarity with West Papuans who have been persecuted and brutalized. So they'll be there to demand the release of all political prisoners, as well as the protection of pro-democracy leader Sayang Mandabayan. So we'll be speaking to Zelda at 7:45. At 8 o'clock, we'll be listening to an excerpt from Out of the Blue, which is a show on 3CR about, sea conservation and marine life. And in this clip, Mimi spoke to Dr. Prue Francis, who is a senior lecturer at Deakin University, about her work to improve ocean literacy, which lines up really well with our last interview for the day.
Yes, which we're going to be speaking to Lisa Deppler from OCEAN, the Otway Coastal Environment Action Network, about further proposals for gas exploration in the Otway Basin and how the community can take a stand against it. I think that's going to be our show for today. But, yeah, lots of ocean-related content.
Yeah, amazing. So, just a reminder, our first segment starts at 7:15, but we'll be back with the news headlines after this.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty now.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and these are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 2nd of September, 2025. Yesterday, it was reported that around 20 anti-genocide activists have locked on to the entrance of Webdock in Naarm, Melbourne, to stop all trade with Israel. Companies such as Maersk, Toll and Zim have been sustaining Israel's settler colonial project by transporting components, parts, weapons and raw materials. Activists are occupying Webdock to stop the supply chains and stand in solidarity with the people of Palestine, as well as the UK action group Palestine Action. In other resistance news, the Global Samud Flotilla has departed from the port of Barcelona. Organisers describe the Global Samud Flotilla as the largest maritime mission to Gaza, bringing together more than 50 ships and delegations from at least 44 countries. The group estimates that the fleet will take between 7 and 8 days to make the approximately 3,000-kilometre journey to Gaza, and this flotilla is the latest attempt to deliver aid by sea and break Israel's siege on Gaza.
And in other news this week, a new report released by Oxfam with support from the Human Rights Centre has revealed labour rights violations in Australian fashion supply chains. The report, entitled Unravelling Exploitation, Exposing the Need for Responsible Business Laws in Fashion Supply Chains, uncovered the risks of modern slavery of child and also child labour practices, particularly in Bangladesh. The research found that there's abundant evidence of child labour under subcontracted situations, as well as job insecurity, financial coercion, and physical and verbal abuse across the industry. Over 20% of workers face delays or deductions from their pay, and additionally, over a quarter of workers experienced forced labour and 95% were paid below a living wage. Nina Crawley, campaign and advocacy lead at Oxfam, highlighted that the research serves a stark reminder that clothes Australians buy come at the cost of someone else's safety and dignity. We urgently need strong, enforceable laws to hold the industry accountable and protect workers from harm. Also in the news, new research from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare has found that New South Wales has the highest number of people under 18 accessing homelessness services in all of Australia. In 2023 to 2024, we saw 22,286 people aged 12 to 17 accessing the specialist homelessness service in New South Wales, and that made up a third of all people accessing the service in the state. And of this cohort, 6,100 of them, a third of the total number of children, were unaccompanied by adults, almost double the number in Victoria. And the Peak Foundation for Youth Homelessness, Y Foundations, has called for sustained investment in children and young people in its approach to tackling homelessness.
In other news, documents obtained by the Environment Centre Northern Territory has revealed that Santos's Darwin LNG facility has been leaking methane since 2006, which has sparked allegations of a gas industry cover-up and systemic regulatory failure. Darwin LNG is strategically important to Australia's position as one of the world's largest LNG exporters and is set to be backfilled with gas from Santos's controversial Barossa project in late 2025. Footage from drone monitoring conducted during 2019-2020 due diligence for the sale of Darwin LNG assets from ConocoPhillips to Santos estimated the leak at up to 184 kilograms per hour. According to the Environment Centre NT, Santos and ConocoPhillips allegedly concealed the leak from the public to prevent it derailing approval for the controversial Barossa project, while multiple government agencies knew about the leak but failed to require Santos to fix it. And this is including the NT Environment Protection Agency and others as well. Despite currently being shut down for works in preparation for backfill with Barossa gas, Santos has not fixed the leak. And so environment groups are calling for, one, Santos to fix the leak, two, the Albanese government to step in and fix the problem, and the NTEPA to make fixing the leak a condition of renewing the licence for Darwin LNG. It should also investigate prosecuting Santos for polluting offences. Kirsty Howie, who is the Executive Director of Environment Centre NT, has said, "This is a national scandal and an unfolding disaster. Santos has been caught red-handed, putting the environment, climate and the health and safety of the people of Darwin at risk, while regulators have been asleep at the wheel."
And finally in the headlines, on August 21st, 2025, Victoria opened its first ever pill testing site. The site is located at 95 Brunswick Street in Fitzroy and operates from Thursday to Saturday every week. Striving towards harm reduction, pill testing saves lives by detecting life-threatening synthetic opioids in pills, powders, crystals, and liquids, while also being completely confidential and free. A quote from the Alcohol and Drug Foundation CEO, Dr. Aaron Lehler, states that it gives people who have already purchased drugs and are intending to use them the opportunity to learn more from trusted health professionals about the drug's strength and key ingredients in a non-judgmental setting. At the same time, it's a unique opportunity to provide them with the other important health information they might not have otherwise accessed. Pill testing also plays a crucial role in keeping health officials up to date and aware of new synthetic dangers circling the Victorian drug market. For further information about pill testing, listen back to Thursday Breakfast Show from last week about the International Overdose Awareness Day 2025 and Victorian Pill Testing Service launch. Head to 3cr.org/Thursday Breakfast for this really important reporting on these issues. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 2nd of September, 2025. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
sex worker rights,
South liberation,
disability justice,
anti-imperialism,
decolonization,
an end to borders,
workers' justice,
and so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo! Woo!
We know you love listening to 3CR, but we also know that many of you haven't downloaded the Community Radio Plus app yet.
The app lets you tune in anywhere and share the station with your friends.
So, show the love and share the love and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Next up, we're going to listen to Dr. Sama Jabbar, a Jerusalem-based psychiatrist, psychotherapist, and writer. Dr. Jabbar recently visited Naam as part of her book tour, and this conversation comes from the book launch for Radiance in Pain and Resilience, which took place 2 weeks ago. And regular listeners of Tuesday Breakfast would know that last week we played another clip from the event in which we heard from Tasnim Samak. And Dr. Jabbar has decades of experience working at the intersection of trauma and political violence, and previously worked as head of the mental health unit at the Palestinian Ministry of Health. And in this excerpt from the book launch, Dr. Jabbar talks about her experiences working in psychology and Palestine and the difficulties of pathologization when it comes to mental health in her homeland.
So I will tell you a little bit more about myself and this book. So that we can engage later in a conversation about it. I come from Jerusalem, and like Tasnim, my mother comes from Yaffa, and she was 3-4 years old when the massive ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians took place. Her father was a school principal, so unlike most of the other Palestinians, they did not become refugees in a refugee camp. They moved to Jerusalem because he had the opportunity. He was a school principal, and he had the opportunity to take responsibility in a school in the old city of Jerusalem. And so they lived in Jerusalem, and I was born in Jerusalem. Yet, a Palestinian from Jerusalem is a temporary resident of Jerusalem. This status makes us aware of the fact that this residency can be provoked very easily. While if an Israeli, a Jewish Israeli person living in Jerusalem gets married to any person in the world, that person coming from abroad will immediately become a citizen while we have temporary residency. So this is just a small example of how it feels to be living under occupation. I am a medical doctor. I graduated from the first medical school created for the Palestinians, Al-Quds University, and soon after finishing my medical school, I got a scholarship to specialize in psychiatry. And that was something that I hoped for, because I observed as a medical student training during the Second Intifada in Palestinian clinics and hospitals, the impact of the political stress on people. During the Second Intifada, many of the Palestinians became unemployed. And so we started receiving men in primary health care complaining of chest pain, palpitation. They thought that they had a heart attack. And we received young children with nocturnal enuresis. And I remember one impressive presentation at the emergency room of Al-Maqasid Hospital, a woman who lost her vision, and there was no organic cause. The last thing that she saw was her son being shot in his eye. So at that point, and as a medical student, I understand that we need psychiatrists in Palestine, and there were very few psychiatrists. All of them were men, with the exception of one woman psychiatrist from Croatia. So I studied in France, I graduated, and I expanded my education in this field by being exposed to several courses on cognitive behavioral therapy, and psychoanalytic psychotherapy, to come back and start working. On the first day, I became the psychiatrist of the Community Mental Health Center in Ramallah in 2006. On my first day of work, I realized that all my Western education is not sufficient to respond to the reality of my work in Palestine. For example, the chef de service in France, he had 3 to 5 patients per day. And I had 60 patients on the first day of my work. So that was a big challenge. People like to practice psychiatry in a country where the need is huge, and the resources, human resources and financial resources, are minimal. It requires of us to do many adaptations. Also, it became clear that many people come to see us because they are in distress and pain that is not necessarily an illness. It can be pathologized easily. So, and when it is pathologized, this will contribute to the negative representations of Palestinians as bad or mad, terrorists or mentally disturbed. And this contributes to the erasure and the denial of the credibility of our cause, of our aspirations, and of our agency as people who want to live freely and have sovereignty on their land. A few more words about the book, and then we will be in conversation. This book has a collection of essays. Some were written before the latest escalation in Gaza. The majority were written in reaction to the escalation in Gaza. This book is about my working and living experience in Palestine. There are many things that I understand through the encounter with people who come seeking help, and other things that I understand as a Palestinian who has a first-hand experience at checkpoints with Israeli soldiers as I go in and out the borders of my land. And probably in many ways, I'm more lucky than most of Palestinians because I maintained relationships outside Palestine that helped me reflect on the Palestinian reality from distance. And I've been connecting with people in solidarity with Palestine in different parts of the world. So the book also talks about the global reverberation of the Palestinian historical trauma, which has effects outside Palestine, ripple effects. Many people, they connect to us because when they watch what happens in Gaza, this stirs up traumatic responses related to their history and past and the past of their ancestors. They can see their ancestors in our reflections. And also many people can be affected by what's taking place in Palestine because their ancestors contributed to the colonization. So I think what we are seeing now in Palestine after almost 680 days of unrelentless carpet bombardment and unprecedented attack on the health system and starvation, demolishing every line of life in Gaza. This is the tipping point in the confrontation between the colonized and the colonizer. And it is relevant to many people in the world. It's an opportunity for the world to look at itself, especially people in colonized countries. They need to look at themselves in the mirror and check their past and see where they want to be, which position they want to take at this very critical and urgent moment in history. It is a chance for people to correct the past of their ancestors, whether you are on the side of the colonized or the colonizer. This is the right moment to take action. Thank you.
We've been listening to Dr. Sama Jabbar we've been listening to her speak about her book launch for Radiance in Pain and Resilience, which recently took place in Nam. And Dr. Jabbar also spoke about her life and work experience working in psychology in Palestine. And up next, we're going to listen to a new release by singer-songwriter Jem Kassar Daly, a Gumnaya and Bundjalung woman.
Can I get just one in? Where all the scattered pieces of my life went, I've been so lost in it. Searching through the rubble, maybe that's where I left it. Even thought about getting sober, cause I'm so prone to losing my composure. Leave my bullshit at the door, yeah, cause it all disappears when I hold ya.
That was Jem Casardaley with her new single Left Pocket, or From Left Pocket. We are now joined by Kristen O'Connell from the Anti-Poverty Centre, who joins us on the show again this morning to talk about the changes made to Centrelink debt policies announced by the government last week. But we'll also be talking about how victim survivors of domestic and family violence are often unfairly held responsible for these debts, and any impact that these latest changes will have to these women. So welcome back to 3CR, Kristen.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I was wondering if you could start by just giving us a brief summary of the government's announcement last week regarding these changes to the social security system.
So the first thing I want folks to know is that there are zero changes related to the Robodebt Royal Commission in what has been announced, and the government did commit to implement all of those recommendations nearly 2 years ago now. So this is responding to a specific legal case that is still ongoing in the courts that is seeking to challenge a calculation method. A court has ruled that it was an unlawful calculation method for debt called income apportionment. Sorry, this is a bit technical, but basically similar to the problem with robo-debt where income can be averaged and time frames for when you report income and things like this, very complicated and technical rules can lead Centrelink to raise a debt even if you just reported your income correctly or made minor mistakes with your income. And this type of debt calculation was used from the 90s through to 2020. And so you can see, like, there's a whole lot in that that they're trying to respond to. And what they've done is say, we are effectively just going to get rid of a whole bunch of small debts because that's going to save us a lot of administration. And they do openly state in the announcement that this isn't about fairness or treating people well. It is actually about saving the government money so they don't have to process all of the recalculations of these unlawful debts. So what they're doing is saying that instead of waiving Centrelink debts under $200 for administrative error, they will increase that to $250. I note that that was last updated in 2003, so we're not really approaching inflation there. And what they're saying is that that will waive around 1.2, very confusing language from the government, that either debts will be waived or never raised, and the number of debts will be 1.2 million, but we don't know how many of those are debts that don't exist yet. So there's no introduction of a time limit on how far back they can go, can still collect or chase the outstanding debt that they have from 1979 on the books. I would say very minimal changes, dressed up as being something very exciting, and there may be payments available to people who have already repaid or have got an unlawful income apportionment debt over about the last 20 years.
Yeah, I think even just trying to unpack the government's announcement, there's just such a lack of clarity there. And we see that as well within the social security system, right? In terms of like the language, in terms of the technicality of things, like you were just saying before, it's quite technical language. And so for people who have to access these systems, I imagine it can be incredibly confusing and stressful at the same time. And like you were just saying, like the slightest mistake could mean that you incur debts, which could have a significant impact on your livelihood.
That's right. And it's not just a minor mistake from you. So it can be a minor mistake from Centrelink. The mistakes can happen on both sides, but if Centrelink makes a mistake and you are underpaid, you only have 13 weeks to try and ask them to pay you back. If you make a mistake and you are, or Centrelink makes a mistake and you are overpaid, in theory, they can just collect that going back. Well, there is no time limit until you die, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, so the onus is always on, like, the individual to rectify things. I know that there's going to be more discussion about this on Thursday breakfast, and so for today's program and today's discussion, Kristen, I wanted to focus on how victim survivors of family violence are often impacted by these debts. So I was wondering if you could explain this to our listeners this morning.
Yes, absolutely. So as with most parts of the social security system, women in particular are disproportionately affected by harmful rules. And also, I would note, First Nations people and First Nations women even more so. What that means is that the rules that can lead to debt disproportionately impact women, and then the effects of that debt also disproportionately impact women. So when we're talking about the rules that contribute to it, there are even one step back from that, actually, you can have economic violence inflicted on people by their current or former partner, or any person in their life actually who wants to, or who they have a relationship of abuse with, can call up Centrelink and report them, right? Now, there doesn't actually have to be something wrong that you've done for someone to draw you to Centrelink's attention and apply extra scrutiny to you and basically to dob you in and say, this person's done something dodgy. Now, even if you have a perfect record and there's absolutely no debt there, Centrelink is then investigating you. And as you can imagine, if you are a welfare recipient surviving in poverty and dealing with these other complex issues, and particularly if you are a parent, having Centrelink starting to dig into your history of payment and reporting is extremely stressful and distressing. And again, users know this. There can also be, there is a lot of coercion around people's reporting. So under-reporting or non-reporting of partner income so that a person continues to receive their payment. So basically, if you're in a relationship, or even if Centrelink decides you're in a relationship and you're not really, you have to report any income from your partner. Now, that reduces the overall household income. So there's a lot of incentive for people to be pressured not to report their income. And then if Centrelink discovers that down the track, not to report their income or their partner's income if they have employment income, and then that creates a debt. Now, you have in theory, well, technically you have broken the rules, right? That's not a mistake, but it is a result of pressure and of abuse. So this is just a couple of examples. And I guess another key one I just wanted to add to that is if you do have a former partner or a partner you're trying to leave and they know you're on a Centrelink payment, they can report to Centrelink that you are still in a relationship, and Centrelink will assume that is correct. Effectively, you would have to jump through a lot of hoops to disprove that. So those are some examples of how you can get a debt that's not exhaustive. And then in terms of how the debt affects you, obviously we have Centrelink can basically garnish your payment. So even though they talk about the ability to waive debt, moving from $200 to $250. At the moment, if you are currently on a Centrelink payment, they can actually only waive your debt if it is $50 or less. So there is a double standard there. For people who are no longer on a Centrelink payment, they can waive a higher amount. If you're currently on a Centrelink payment, you can have some of that taken away. And so we actually have no clarity from the announcement last week as to whether that $50 limit is changing or if it's just changing for people who don't get a Centrelink payment. And for people who are in that situation, obviously, when you are trying to either leave a violent relationship or you are trying to establish yourself having left one, or you are trying to keep your kids alive as a single parent who has had to leave a violent relationship, Centrelink taking away part of your payment really exacerbates those circumstances and, again, has an even harsher impact than people who are not in that situation.
Thank you for that, Kristen. And I know that Economic Justice Australia did produce a report a few years ago about looking into victim survivors of family violence and how they are unfairly, you know, often responsible for debts, and this is like a direct result of the actions of perpetrators and the people that are committing this abuse against them. And you sort of alluded to this now, like, are there any, there's no, is there any explicit mention of these new changes to the social security system that help to address this or, you know, help provide justice for victim survivors?
Yeah, so technically there are some provisions already that are designed to assist people, but the way they are applied is really inconsistent. The government has talked and actually really emphasised how this will benefit people experiencing family and domestic violence, but there is nothing in the announcement that shows how that would be the case. And so at the moment it's really hard for us to understand, are they doing something specific to support people in that situation, or is this just a vague statement that responds to what we're talking about here today, that there is disproportionate harm to people in that situation and so us doing anything will disproportionately support them? And you mentioned Economic Justice Australia, and I just want to let people know, if they're not sure what Economic Justice Australia is or what community legal centres are, if you ever receive a Centrelink debt of any kind, unless you are 1,000% confident that Centrelink is correct, have a look at the Economic Justice Australia website, look up the legal centre in your area, because it is free legal support, and Centrelink have a long track record of miscalculating debts, even just by mistake, not just because they're unlawful program. And so we always encourage people to go to EJA, look up that legal centre, get help before you talk to Centrelink about the debt. Because, yeah, there can be no trust in this system. And I think what we really need to see is this, again, shift away from a hunting down poor people system to try and extract money from us, to a making sure everyone got the right payment system and making sure that people aren't punished or penalised or put into further poverty because of mistakes.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Kristen. I was going to say, like, it just outright seems like a punitive approach to welfare, or it's built on, like, punishment, which provides no justice to anyone whatsoever. So thank you so much for that. And, yeah, I just wanted to reiterate what you said just now about seeking advice and legal help, because I imagine getting that notification and being informed of having accrued a debt can be incredibly stressful. And, you know, I think a lot of people have belief in these systems because they, you know, want to believe that these systems are supporting them and looking out for them, but that's really not the case. And we've seen that with robo-debt, and we're seeing that time and time again. So
one last thing I must add is the government will not automatically repay people who have already paid off one of these debts. So people will have to look on the Services Australia website and call up Services Australia and say, hey, I think I had an income and apportionment debt in 2004. Can you help me check? So just letting people know, please do, if you might have had a debt, even if you're not sure, call Services Australia and find out, because they might owe you money.
Thank you so much for that. And on that note, I guess we'll wrap up our conversation today, but I know that Thursday Breakfast will be continuing the conversation later this week. So thanks so much for joining us again, Kristen.
Cheers, mate.
We've been speaking to Kristen O'Connell from the Anti-Poverty Centre, speaking about debt policies, Centrelink debt policies, and also how they unfairly impact victim survivors of family violence. Make sure you tune into Thursday Breakfast this week, as Inez will be speaking to Jay from the Anti-Poverty Centre about how to resolve debt issues in the social security system. And for regular news and updates, you can head to the Anti-Poverty Centre Media Hub at apcentre.substack.com. And we are going to go to another song now before our next interview.
Yep, so up next we're going to listen to a new song by Benny, a singer-songwriter from Aotearoa, and this song is called Cinnamon.
I'll stay sweet like cinnamon. I'll stay asleep till 3 p.m.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. Reach out today for guidance and support. Visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you're currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Want to become a socially progressive podcaster but don't know where to start?
3CR has a wealth of podcasting knowledge and experience, and we've developed a practical podcast training course to help community voices get into the world of podcasting.
Our 2-day in-station course is perfect for new podcasters or people who want to improve their skills and get some insider tips.
Enroll now for our October podcast course.
Full details at 3cr.org.au/podcast services.
Or call the station during business hours on 03 9419 8377.
Enroll now for our October podcast course.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, and previously we were listening to a new song by Benny entitled Cinnamon. And up next we're going to listen to another new release from alternative rock group The Boys, who are based on Gadigal land, and this is their new song, Bitch.
Safe to say I know you think you're better than me. Learn to read it on your face. Lips and eyes that shoot daggers at me. God forbid I have something to say. So tell me how you figured out all the answers. Well, I'm over here thinking I prefer mine. probably thinking that I'm on my way out. But I was just catching my breath in the cold. I'm good, I don't give up, I'm devout. Just know that it's getting old.
Want to know what happened at the 2024 People's Blockade of the World's Largest Coal Port?
Come along to a special 3CR screening of Turning the Ship, the short film that explains all, and be inspired to join the blockade this year.
Revisit the epic event and hear how this incredible people-powered protestival came together.
Join us on Friday, 19th September at Evil Thoughts in East Brunswick.
Head to Rising Tide Victoria Insta or Facebook page to RSVP and to get all the details.
Rising Tide Victoria is a 3CR supporter.
Even Arnie in the 90s had a car that ran electric. They held back the tech. Now it's gotten hectic. They can't.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on the 2nd of September, and we just played a new song by The Boys entitled Bitch. And up next, we're going to play another song. This is Sea Glass by Yasmin Lacey.
Thank you. to the ocean floor. Mother water, tell me of them when and how. Know that it's inside. Let go.
Ocean literacy refers to our understanding of the ocean, its influence on us, and our influence on it. On Sunday, the 24th of August, Dr. Prue Francis, senior lecturer at Deakin University, joined Out of the Blue to discuss her work to improve ocean literacy, helping community members understand this connection so we can make informed choices that protect the ocean into the future.
There's kind of a bit of a growing focus on this space, and that you've been really involved in research as well as advocacy on this topic. Why do you think this is gaining momentum and so kind of becoming more of a focus? What makes it so important right now?
Concept, yeah, I think globally, internationally, it's building momentum. And here in Australia, we've just had our nation, and we've got a whole suite of different marine education programs or marine initiatives that folks can get engaged with. We often haven't collectively called it ocean literacy. And so I think that's sort of where we've been doing well in that space for so many years, but actually bringing it together where we've got practitioners of ocean literacy, but also now a growing body of researchers, bringing us together in this coordinated fashion to think about how, as a nation, do we put this as a strategy moving forward? Like, how can we actually bring us all together and go, well, this is what's currently happening. This is where we need to go into the future so that we can build that strategy and help align with changing climate and the pressures that the ocean is facing now. And I guess with our recent events that we're seeing, Northern Great Barrier Reef, Ningaloo, having coral bleaching over the last few months and seeing the devastating impact there. Down in our southern area, we're seeing the harmful algal bloom impacting the South Australia coastline. So these climate emergencies are happening more regularly now. And as a nation, we need to start being proactive about that instead of reactive. And ocean literacy plays a huge role in building that knowledge and that data and connecting the community with the scientific community to build that trust and that be transparent of what we're finding from a science point of view and communicating that back to the community. And that's where that ocean literacy can play a role. And so from a research perspective, we're trying to find ways of how to build that connection better. What are some really good ways to communicate data to the public? What are some great workshops or interventions that we can create that can build that ocean literate society moving forward? And so that's where their field is emerging at the moment, is trying to build that better conduit between the different stakeholders and user groups of the ocean.
I'm really interested in the kind of intersection of art with climate activism and advocacy and research. I think creative arts can be such a powerful and meaningful way for people to learn and connect with other human experiences and environmental and the kind of more than human experiences and stories as well. I saw that you co-authored a children's book, The Great Southern Reef, and also use some other kind of creative activities in your education work. I'd love to know, what is it about storytelling and creative strategies like writing a children's book that kind of draws you to use these methods as part of that communication?
Yeah, that's a huge converter to the transdisciplinary approach to communicating about the ocean. And so what that means is bringing the science, bringing an artist and communicating it in a different way to what our traditional method would be as a scientist, which would be a research paper or a communication written piece. But artist and storytelling is a more engaging way, bringing that knowledge in a way that's not as obvious that you're doing so. And so it could be through the visual storytelling of a children's picture book and through the words explaining what that visual picture looks like to sort of resonate with people in a different way. And perhaps with that picture book for as an example, it shows children walking along the beach and finding different curiosities that get washed up, and perhaps somebody reading that might recognise some of those items that they've seen at their local beach, and that's then building that connection in a different way instead of perhaps having to read a research paper or a textbook and trying to identify that particular item that got washed up on the beach. So it's a nice way without being, I guess, too obvious they're learning about a science particular angle. I've also been working with artists in ways of communicating about the kelp restoration work that we've been doing as well. And that's been a really eye-opener experience for me to know that I do a lot of public speaking. And so communicating my research through an artistic angle and having these brilliant artists interpret it in a different way and bring a different audience to connect with the kelp restoration has been phenomenal. And I think moving forward, if we are going to try to be more ocean literate and talk about the ocean, we've got to do it in different ways. And storytelling and art is going to be pivotal in that solution. And particularly thinking about our communities that don't live near the coast, or people that may not be able to access the ocean in the same way that I can access the ocean. I'm very privileged to be able to go snorkeling and swimming, and so I can see what's underneath. And a lot of people might not be able to do that. So how can we bring that experience that I can have to somebody that can't, and how can they build that same a connection in a different way? So thinking outside the box of how we communicate that not only the beauty of the ocean, but also the threats and the challenges that it's facing, to sort of help people understand of what they can do in their everyday life to help contribute towards protecting and conserving.
Mm, yeah, that makes so much sense. I'd love to know more about what the impact has been for people who, for example, have maybe interacted with some of the arts outcomes you were talking about around kelp restoration, or have you had any feedback from families who've used the book in their kind of learning about the ocean? Like, how has that kind of resonated with people?
Yeah, so with the book specifically, I do have quite a lot of evidence of the impact that that's had, which is fantastic. And so that book has been part of a body of work or research work that we've been working on at Deakin University, and Katia Freitas, Dr. Katia, led a lot of that work. And so that was looking at ways that picture books can teach about the ocean in a primary school setting. And so we were able to upscale Katia's work from her PhD into delivering that program across 100 schools in Port Phillip Bay. And we have impact from those schools of using that book, and some lovely schools have even got reached out to myself and co-author Paul Venzo to write our stories and tell us about their experiences of the Great Southern Reef and their favourite marine animal.
Wow.
But then also, which has been lovely, pitching what we should write for our next book about the Great Southern Reef. So we've got those wonderful ideas from lots of children around Victoria of what we should do for book number two, and just creating this pen pal experience in exchange. But then also I've gone to different schools and talked about the Great Southern Reef because they've read the book, or they've been developing specific science activities or creative storytelling themselves in that school setting. So it's been a wonderful resource from that point of view. And then inspiring older children, so maybe late primary or early secondary, to create their own stories as well, to become a storyteller. And that's been fantastic. And then from the kelp restoration, the art that we've been doing, see the impact of people wanting to know more. So we do have been engaged to do a lot of beach walk. We're walking on the beach and talking about seaweed and the restoration and the issues that our local kelp are facing. And that's, you know, I guess the impact of there has just been more events and more opportunities to talk about what we've been doing in that space. And so quite often I'm talking at community groups that about the project and various workshops and what have you around to sort of show that impact. So I think getting out into the community is super important to talk about what we've been doing and hearing other people's perceptions of their own experience going down to their local environment, and perhaps seeing the kelp or the ecosystem change over time has, and knowing that something's been done about it, I think really resonates with quite a lot of people, which has been great. And we've been receiving that feedback quite a bit too.
I'm wondering, do you have any advice for people who are wanting to help kind of raise ocean literate children and young people, and for families? I'm also thinking kind of about climate anxiety and the challenges for young people at the moment who are growing up and managing emotions around the reality of climate crisis, especially with some of these really devastating climate events at the moment. Do you have any advice for talking about these issues in age-appropriate ways and kind of helping to nurture that generation of ocean literate young people?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And eco or climate anxiety is real. And I think we all need to make sure we're looking after it, yourself and each other, in the space of, you know, what we are seeing on the news and in the articles and in the data. And yeah, recognizing that, those feelings. But in terms of how you communicate that to children, how do you help children navigate through those feelings? It's I think it's really important for them to understand what is happening, but then also making sure that there's some blue hope in that communication as well. And so, whilst, you know, you might have a ecological event that's happening that is being devastating, knowing that there are scientists that are out there monitoring and helping to obtain that data so that into the future we can be proactive about how we might go about protecting some of those threatened species if this event was to occur again, or even looking at the context of what we've been doing in the restoration space with kelp, is the main issue in Port Phillip Bay was the overabundance of purple sea urchin that have been feeding or overgrazing on our golden kelp. And so what we've been able to do there, that again, if that overwhelming sense of, oh, our kelp are declining, what should we do about it? There are researchers and scientists out there that are trying to either get baseline data or come up with cool new innovative techniques to help mitigate or contribute to some of the solutions and challenges that the ocean's facing. So I think often we see in the news is the devastating impacts of our environment, which I think we need to engage with, but we also need to look at the ways that there are these really innovative, cool ideas that are getting put out there that also need to be celebrated, that it's not just doom and gloom. There is people working in that space to try and overcome these challenges. So I was trying to find that balance in that storytelling, I think, is the way forward, and making inspiring children to, you know, if you were a scientist right about now, what could you do to help with this? And they can start to sort of have that problem solving thinking right at that early age, and of how they could tackle that problem if they were a scientist or an engineer or an oceanographer, whatever it might be, that they can start to sort of think, you know, I can be part of those solutions in the future.
Are there any kind of, I guess, signs that we'll know we're on the right track, that we're kind of on the way towards a more ocean literate culture?
Yeah, it's a great question, and a very timely one, I should add, because my PhD student, Consuelo, is about to deploy Australia's first ocean literacy baseline survey. Wow. So that is a survey, a bunch of questions that have been developed by colleagues in Canada, and we are using those questions, and we've also added our own Australian specific ones to that suite. And that will be going out to a sample size of 2,000 people around Australia, and making sure that we're getting folks from all across our states and territories. And that will be our first baseline to sort of understand where we are at. And the idea would be that we can have a checking point at various times across the years to see whether we are improving from that particular survey. And so this survey has already been deployed across, I think it's over 10 different countries now, and there is an online platform that you can go to see the results of those surveys across those different countries. So the idea is that this survey will also be put onto that platform, so Australia can be part of that global overview or health point check about ocean literacy, and see, hopefully we can deploy this in a couple of years' time again to see if we're starting to see potentially some of the interventions or the improvements that we're trying to do in ocean literacy here in Australia improve into the future. So I guess that's sort of the vision, and what we're hoping to do as a collective body of folks working in ocean literacy in Australia is to come together and form an ocean literacy coalition. And part of that coalition's agenda and priority will be to develop Australia's first national ocean literacy strategy, which help inform what we need to do to become more ocean literate. And it will use that baseline survey to sort of help build on what that strategy will look like. And this is off the base of other countries also having strategies. So it's not a new concept. We can use what the other countries have done in the past as a bit of a template or a draft to build on what specifically Australia needs to sort of move ocean literacy into the future.
There's kind of a bit of...
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and it is 8:14 a.m. That was Dr. Prue Francis speaking to Mimi from Out of the Blue about her work to improve ocean literacy. You can listen to Out of the Blue on Sundays, 11:30 to 12 p.m. on 3CR. And up next, we've got Lisa Depler, a campaigner from Ocean, which is the Otway Coastal Environment Action Network. And regular listeners of Tuesday Breakfast may remember that we've previously spoken to Greta, who's also from Ocean, to talk about the risks of potential seismic blasting off the coast of the Otways. But today, Lisa is joining us to chat about new proposals for gas exploration in the Otway Basin and how the community can take a stand to resist them. And we'll also chat about previous efforts by Ocean to protect the Otways from gas and, particularly in the long haul. But thanks for joining us, Lisa.
Hi, Juliet. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. So good to have you on today. So, Lisa, can you start off, just giving us, previously we spoke to Greta a bit about the, I think it was the CGG gas blasting proposal, which was a separate project. Maybe could you give us a little bit of an overview on like what's been happening in the Otway Basin in terms of gas development projects that's been going on this year?
For sure, yeah. I'll give you a quick snapshot of what's out there.
Yeah.
It can be really hard for the layperson to know what is happening out there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, well, at the moment, We have ConocoPhillips. They are hoping, oh no, they are planning to put in two exploration wells later on this year. We've got CGG who are applying to do a fairly big 3D seismic blasting off the coast of Warrnambool and Port Ferry. That has been rejected four times now by the regulator NOPSEMA, and largely thanks to a lot of citizen science and community pressure that's been put on, and it's been sent back to the proponents for the fourth time, which has got to be a record. So we feel like we're winning on that side. What else is going on? There's Beach Energy has got a lot of stuff going on, some decommissioning and new wells being put in. To be honest, Ocean doesn't really focus a lot on that because it's fairly localised around the Port Campbell area, and it is delivering essential gas that we need in Victoria and up the East Coast at the moment. But, of course, last year we had our massive victory where Schlumberger pulled out of their seismic blasting in the Otway Basin. It was going to be, if it had have been successful, the largest 3D seismic blasting project in world history. And we fought 2 years to stop that one. It got rejected three times, and then the proponent withdrew their application. So it just shows we can win sometimes.
Yeah, no, it really does. It sounds like, you know, that community pressure is really working. And, yeah, you said, with that, the big seismic blasting proposal last year and then also the ones that have been coming up this year. Yeah, time and time again, it seems like the community is able to put a stop to it, which is awesome. But, we have just heard last week that the Victorian government announced that they're going to open up public consultation for a further release of possible gas exploration within state waters, and that'll extend northwest from the Bay of Islands Coastal Protection Reserve. Could you talk us through what this actually means?
Yeah, well, this is state waters. The Victoria government runs the first 5 kilometres from the shoreline out, and then it's federal waters. A lot of those projects I just discussed were in federal waters and we were dealing with the federal government. This time the Victorian government want a piece of the action, and they're proposing two sites, roughly 50 square kilometres of Bay of Islands in the Otway Basin, and also an area 200 square kilometres in the Gippsland Basin. These are just a proposal at this stage. It's where the government puts their proposal out there and fossil fuel companies suggest what they might do in that area. They put it out for tender, basically. So at this stage, the Victorian government has put it out for consultation for the Victorian people to comment on. And that's where we really need your help to get the word out there, to get some people pushing back on this.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, that's why it's so important to have people like you, Lisa, actually be explaining, you know, what the difference is between all these different proposals. You know, even just that idea of, you know, this one is in state water versus the other ones were in federal water. I think, you know, that's something that, yeah, the average person, it can be really hard to actually understand what the difference is and, you know, why is there another proposal? We do really appreciate you stepping us through that. But could you talk us through a little bit more about, you know, what would be the threats of this further exploration, particularly when it's so close to shore?
Yeah, well, we've called this campaign We'll Fight Them on the Beaches because it's literally on the beaches and goes out 5 kilometres. There will need to be seismic blasting if they want to see what sort of resources are down there. In the proposal, they have said that they want seismic blasting kept to a minimum, but there will be need to be some. In those sort of shallow conditions where the water's not so deep, it'll be devastating for marine life. We don't need any more seismic blasting going on in the Otway Basin. There's obviously, we don't want more industrialisation of the Otway Basin. If they are successful and they find gas, we're talking more infrastructure to connect that area to existing processing plants.
We're talking about more traffic in the ocean of, and more risk of spills when they're drilling and moving stuff around. It's just the industrialisation of the area, which is, you know, not great for any of our marine life, especially, you know, our southern right whales that use that area for feeding, breeding and migration at really important times of the year. And obviously, you know, the use of methane, it's 80% more potent to global warming over a 20-year period than is carbon. So we should not be digging up any more methane at the moment.
Yeah, definitely not. I think, you know, the list really goes on as to the damage, that could really be posed by, this gas exploration in this area, near the Bay of Islands. Of course, you know, we've discussed as well, you know, that this isn't the first time that Ocean has stood up against, you know, these massive projects in the Otway Basin. But yeah, in terms of, you know, in the long term, what can we do to protect this area? And is there any way that, you know, it wouldn't have to be the community standing up and fighting every new proposal that comes through?
Yeah, it's exhausting.
Yeah, it would be.
It really is. And you sort of think, oh, I wish they'd just stop. I'd like to have a break. In the immediate time, I suppose we really like people to jump on to Ocean's website, which is www.ocean.org.au, and put in either a very brief response to the questionnaire or even put in a submission. We really need to nip this one in the bud. If we can stop the release of these titles, and I do think that if we have a good response from the Victorian coastal community, the Victorian government will not go ahead with this. I do feel like they're just testing the waters and they're testing us. So I do think we can win this one. So if people were to jump on our site and respond in some way just to add to the numbers, I think it will help heaps.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like, you know, that strategy's worked before, you know, people getting involved and, you know, voicing their concerns.
In the long term.
Yeah.
I don't know how to answer that, Juliet.
No, that's okay. Yeah, I guess it does sound like you've just been flat out, you know, fighting each new proposal, that it can be hard to actually have time to look at the long term and, you know, figure out.
Well, I guess the long term is to think about next year's Victorian election.
That's true.
If the Allan government does the wrong thing by us here, that's our opportunity to make long-term change, is how we vote.
That's definitely a consideration. And we really appreciate you coming on air today, Lisa, and chatting to us about all these proposals and how the community can get involved and fight back.
Thank you very much for having us. Call us anytime.
Oh, thank you so much, Lisa. We definitely will be in touch again. You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and we've been speaking to Lisa Depler from Ocean, which is the Otway Coastal Environment Action Network, about the risks of further proposals for gas exploration in the Otway region. And you can find out more about the proposal at www.ocean.org/vic-gas-exploration, and you can also follow them on Instagram at Ocean Climate Network. A good place to stay tuned.
Kafirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kafir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kufiyas.org.au. That's kufiyas.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Yo. You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and we've had a busy show today. But before we finish, we're going to do the events calendar. So today, the 2nd of September at 11:30 a.m, there's going to be the ANZ divestment action taking place at 60 Leicester Street in Carlton, and people are encouraged to bring their bikes to that action. Then tomorrow, Wednesday, 3rd of September, from 7:30 to Thursday the 4th at 1:30 p.m, there's going to be a vigil for Gaza at Collins Street Baptist Church at 174 Collins Street in the city. Also on Thursday at 6 p.m, there's going to be an event, Talking Country, Liberation, Freedom and Restitution, at Balumbalum Place at 15 Phoenix Street in Brunswick. And then also on Thursday at 6 p.m, there's the Tatrees Workshop with Samarkand, which will be taking place at Unassigned Gallery in Brunswick. And then finally, there's also the eco-socialism event taking place from Friday the 5th of September to Sunday the 7th of September, and the theme is Eco-Socialism is Not Barbarism, and you can come and meet activists from across the Indo-Pacific to share experiences in resisting capitalism's drive to barbarism and building mass movements. And yeah, I think that's all for the events today, but yeah, we've had a really massive show today. So starting at 7:15, we listened to a recording from Dr. Sama Jabbar, who is a psychologist, psychotherapist and writer who is from and has worked in Palestine and shared her experiences in that field. And then at 7:30, we spoke to Kristen O'Connell from the Anti-Poverty Centre, who joined us to chat about changes made to Centrelink debt policies that were announced by the government last week, and particularly how survivors and victims of domestic and family violence can be unfairly held responsible for these debts. And then at 8 o'clock, we listened to a recent segment from Out of the Blue, in which Dr. Prue Francis, a senior lecturer at Deakin University, discussed her work to improve ocean literacy, help community members understand this connection, so that we can make more informed choices to protect the ocean in the future. And then finally at 8:15, we continued the conversation about oceans, this time speaking to campaigner Lisa Deppler from the Otway Coastal Environment Action Network, or OCEAN as the acronym, and we spoke about the threat of new proposals for gas exploration in the Otway Basin after previous proposals earlier this year, and how the community can take a stand to resist them. So yeah, it's been a really busy day today here in the studio, yeah, this has been Tuesday Breakfast, and yeah, up next will be Accent of Women, so stay tuned to 3CR at 8:55 a.m.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.